Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everyone. Glad to have you along with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show, coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. We hope to have a good show, and we hope to have you participate in the program today. If you would like to do that, please give us a call at 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. If you're over around Washington, D.C. way, you can give us a call at our Washington Bureau, 202-370-6153. And Phoenix, at the Phoenix Bureau, 623-444-5252. So we've got all those telephone numbers out of the way. How are you today? I've been busy catching up on work. You ever get so far behind that you just can't, you seem like you're just treading water and you can't possibly catch up? That's the way I've been lately. Been losing a little sleep over it, I think. But finally, it looks like there's maybe a little light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe we're starting to catch up anyway. We're going to have Brad Friedman on the program today. He's going to be with us, I think, right after the 4 o'clock news break. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Don't have that information right in front of me right now. But Brad's going to be along and talk about the latest voting problems here in this country. I'm anxious to find out if he knows anything about that deal going on down in Mexico right now. Where's that going to go? I think Bush and crew taught them everything they know. Wonder if they've got any hanging chads and pregnant chads and dimpled chads and all that sort of thing. I don't know. As always, a lot going on in the news today. And by the way, I did want to, someone sent me an email yesterday that said they didn't think I did justice to Kenny Lay yesterday. Said that story was just so all-fired important. I got to be honest with you. I didn't think it was that important a story. Yes, the man died. You know, condolences to his family and all that, but he was going to go to prison. He'd been tried and convicted of a crime, a major crime, and he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison since he was not going to interact with the public anymore. I didn't see any sense in spending a big, long time on it. Pretty much his life is over. His interaction with the American public is over, and so I couldn't see what the big deal was. Everybody's spending hours on it. Yesterday, I really didn't, but maybe Maybe that's why they're on national networks and I'm not. I don't know. But I did dig up one little letter here in my files. That I heard Tony Snow, and what caused me to do this, I heard Tony Snow today, yesterday, ask about Kenneth Lay, I guess, of 2121 Kirby Drive, Houston, Texas. And he said that Mr. Bush was an acquaintance. He said Ken Lay was an acquaintance. Let me ask you something. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen this. This letter was sent back in 97 from Mr. Bush to Ken Lay. And that, you tell me if this is a letter you send to an acquaintance. It's from the State of Texas Office of the Governor. It's on official stationery. Dear Ken, one of the sad things about old friends is that they seem to be getting older just like you. 55 years old. Wow, that's really old. Thank goodness you have such a young, beautiful wife. Laura and I value our friendship with you. Best wishes to Linda, your family, and friends. Your younger friend, George W. Bush. I could be wrong, but I don't think I've ever sent a letter like that to an acquaintance. Have you? Just points out one more time what a hopeless liar this man is. So Ken Lay will end up being a criminal. What's wrong with saying, yeah, I knew him. He was a friend of mine. He got off the track. He went bad. He went wrong. He went to prison. It's not my fault. But yes, I knew him. He was a friend of mine. And maybe even, since he's a friend of mine, he still has my friendship. I'll stand behind him. I know what he did was wrong, but he's my friend. And friends are friends, and that's how it is. What would be wrong with doing that? Instead of coming out looking like the ridiculous liar. Now, this letter's floated around quite a little bit around the country. He was an acquaintance, said Tony Snow. So, there you have it. Just more and more and more big lies coming out of the White House. They wouldn't acknowledge that the sun was coming up in the morning. They wouldn't mention it. They really wouldn't. And I, looking around the internet this afternoon, just one last thing that caught my eye here. How many of you saw that SOB sheriff of St. Tammany Parish? During the Katrina thing going on. I didn't think too kindly of him then, and I guess I think even less kindly of him now. But how'd you like to live in a community that had a guy like this for a sheriff? Obviously, there are a lot of people who live in that parish. It's kind of like a county in other states. I'd be all for getting rid of this guy if he was my sheriff. The sheriff of St. Tammany Parish is not too kind to a certain element of people. The news items say he won't coddle criminals from New Orleans, but I hear him tout a different message. He states that your civil rights won't be violated after he says, now I don't get into calling people names and all that, but if you're going to walk the streets of St. Tammany Parish with dreadlocks and a chiwi hairstyle, then you can expect to be getting a visit from a sheriff's deputy. Never ends there, does it? Never ends. And I'm sorry to my friends in the South, but I think you'll have to admit that it's not dead. It's not near dead. And I'm not talking about New Orleans either. New Orleans will be built back into a thriving major city to the great city that it was long before racism ever disappears completely from this country. Sad but true. Very sad, but true. I'd be all for getting a petition up to vote that guy out if he lived in my territory. Hey, how many of you live in a place like I do here? In Florida, the county I live in, this is not a major metropolitan area, and it's certainly not major. But the sheriff's budget here, where I live, is $142 million a year. Only 4 years ago, it was about $40 million. And now it's $142 million a year. I forget how many. Every deputy has his own car. They don't go to work and then take the car out. Every deputy's got their own car. They've got vehicles they don't know what to do with. I've never seen money wasted like they do here in the sheriff's department. That's my opinion, anyway. Looking through the news and some film clips that I didn't get to see on the 4th. On the 4th, I saw this video of Bush telling the troops at Fort Bragg. Anybody been to Fort Bragg? I have. It's a big, sprawling complex. Of course, he had to go there and give a speech with the safety of troops all around him. He loves to do that, doesn't he? Couldn't go to a regular group of folks. No. He's got to have his soldiers all around and make him look like a big man. And he said, I'm going to make you this promise. I'm not going to allow the sacrifice of 2,527 troops who have died in Iraq to be in vain by pulling out before the job is done. Do you get the positively perverted logic in that statement? If he were being truthful, he should say that death is only honorable and proper, you know, and proper if it's followed by more death. Can you say Vietnam? Have you ever been stuck on the phone to one of those customer service centers in Bombay or New Delhi? And after an hour or so, you've spent so much time, you know, you've got so much time invested that you almost hate to give up. You don't have time to wait, but you want to hang up so bad. Your hour spent waiting on the phone would be wasted if you hung up now. So you stay on the line till they answer. And so you wait for another hour while they say, oh, so sorry, we apologize for the wait. And by now you're desperate to get off the phone. But if you do, you'll have wasted 2 hours with no resolution to your problem. You're hooked. You've got to stay on the phone. And I really think that's what Bush is faced with right now. After all, he's absolutely must. I hope that he's at least bright enough to see that the whole thing is imploding over in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm thinking he wants out, but he can't accept what it will look like if we leave now. It truly will make us look like a bunch of fools in the eyes of the world, but here's the rub. We're already the fools to the rest of the world. Leave or stay, they don't care. The Americans have made a grave error by going into Iraq, and there's no way on God's green earth that we can come out of there victorious. No chance. There never was a chance of that, and there never will be a chance of that. And like I said, the same goes for Afghanistan, where according to all reports, the situation's deteriorating by the hour, with Karzai getting no respect at all from the Afghani people. And I've been hearing reports that he has to walk around Kabul with 100 to 200 American military guards just to keep people from killing him. This popular puppet that we put in office. A friend of mine's in Kabul right now, sending back regular emails. Maybe some of you know her, Jane Stillwater. Good blogger, sends out some good stories. She's over there right now. Interesting to hear her stories, but Bush doesn't need to feel alone in this deal. Nixon and Johnson had the same decision with the Vietnam debacle. Look at how many more thousands died needlessly while that unwinnable mess continued on. We had to cut and run Somalia, but no one's looked at any Americans who died there as anything less than heroes. So it is possible to get out without ruining the reputation of our soldiers. Our government? No, that's another story. The families and the friends of those soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan needn't worry about the legacy of the soldiers. Whether this mission was a mistake or not, their personal stories stand on their own. And they're not at all related to whether or not we won the war. They would really do well to remember that many men are thought of as heroes in the Vietnam War, even though there was no victory. I would encourage all the veterans who have lost people in Afghanistan and Iraq to remember that. But the time's definitely arrived where we've got to say enough is enough, and we've got to move on. This has been a failure from the very beginning, and it's time to start considering the awful consequences to follow if we stay. Those people hate us, and there's nothing we can do to make things better. We've got to leave their land and allow them to work things out for themselves. We have to. I should think just about anybody could see right now that it's just not working. You know, we got Zarqawi. And all the big deal they made over killing Zarqawi. Now we know that that was nothing. Didn't amount to anything. The violence has gotten worse since Zarqawi's been killed. But they paraded his body, you know, the pictures of his body around. So, oh, look how great we are. We got Zarqawi. We got Hussein and Kuste and... Yeah, and what good has any of it done? What good has any of it done? I don't know. I really don't know. Well, gee whiz, I got an email already asking, are we having technical issues? No, we are not. I think we're streaming fine. And I'll just send him that message out. There we go. Nothing like doing our work here right in front of the audience, huh? Had that issue yesterday. A couple of people said that they couldn't get the program. But we had a healthy audience yesterday, and we had a lot of feedback. So I guess a lot of people. Anyway, you know, I was talking on here about the Mideast over there where we're embroiled right now, and we can't seem to extricate ourselves from this terrible situation. How are we going to get out of there? When are we going to get out of there? But I don't think a lot of Americans understand why. And they don't even understand the fact that we are hated by so many people in that area. And if you knew the history of that area, particularly, you know, forget the Crusades, if that wasn't enough. You know, let's go on to some more recent history, right after the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire was carved up, and they didn't carve it up. We did, with the help of the French and the British. We carved it up, and we told them what was going to be what, and we told the Syrians the French are going to be running their country, and we told the British, actually, told the Palestinians, don't you worry, we're going to let you have your land. We're only going to bring in about 8% of outsiders there. You have nothing to worry about, and look what's happened to them. Look what's happened to the whole area. It was the West that has caused the hatred they have for us over there right now. But I looked up one particular incident, you know, and I'd almost forgotten about it, and I had to go searching last night. I wonder if you remember this particular story. I know I do now that I was reminded about it. But George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, in August of 1988, as the vice president said, and let me quote this, "I will never apologize for the United States of America ever. I don't care what it has done. I don't care what the facts are. I will not apologize." Now, when you say that to a country, and I'm talking about Iran, after you've shot down one of their airliners, a commercial airliner with 290 passengers on it, and they all died because of a mistake our military made, and you stand there and say, "I will never apologize for the United States of America ever. I don't care what it has done. I don't care what the facts are. I won't apologize." You wonder why there might be a little bit of animosity from those folks towards us? It was 18 years ago, just a few days ago, when Iran Air Flight 655 took off from Bandar Abbas, Iran, at approximately 10 o'clock in the morning, on its way to Dubai in the UAE, with 290 passengers and crew aboard. It carried 38 non-Iranians and included 66 children. It was running 27 minutes late on its 28-minute flight. The short distance made for a simple flight pattern, climb to 14,000 feet, level off, then descend into Dubai. It was flying in a commercial air corridor, 20-mile-wide lane on a direct line to the Dubai airport. What the nearly 300 passengers of the plane didn't know was that 12,000 feet below it was the USS Vincennes, which had drifted 4 kilometers into Iran's territorial waters while engaging small Iranian gunboats. The Vincennes was 40 miles north of the position that the fleet headquarters had ordered it to be. And it's a long, drawn-out story, but the Vincennes saw this plane and shot it down. It was that simple. It was a mistake. It was an awful mistake. And 290 civilians died. And the Vice President of the United States said, I will never apologize. I don't care what we've done. I will never apologize. How would you feel against a guy of another country that said that to you after 290 of your fellow countrymen had been obliterated by a missile? I don't know. Don't think I'd like it very much. And I do understand some of the hatred. I really do. Let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Guy, it's Dave.
Hi, Dave.
I've shared a thought with you before, and I think I've connected it well enough that I think it's deserving of being repeated, because you and everybody wants to not see the magnitude of criminality that is running our government right now. They planned this out. This involves a new world order, a shift of great wealth, global domination. Victory for these guys is transferring how many billions and trillions of dollars out of our treasury to Bechtel, to Halliburton, to the Carlyle Group. That's what they're doing. And they're saying, in effect, we can't leave. It is just too damn profitable to us. And that's the driving force. I am convinced of it. They planned it out from the earliest days of PNAC. That's why they're there. And that's why they're not leaving. They'll tell us any lie that they have to throw us in the wrong direction. But their purpose for being there is pure outrageous greed.
Well, that's how they measure ethics and right and wrong today, is by who's got the most money. I mean, that's how it's measured.
Right? And they're willing to do damn near anything to become the richest people in the world, the first trillionaires. They fully intend that. I'm convinced of it.
Yeah, I agree. It's becoming more and more apparent. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. We were having this deep, and I'm afraid, very dark discussion about this. Where are we going as a people? And our morality, it's gone. It's just nearly gone. And I'm so ashamed of what's happening in this country now. And, you know, not only what we're doing to citizens of other countries in the world, but what we're having done to our own people is shameful. It really is.
Well, you know, and I take it even further. I think that the character of these folks, this Rove Cheney, this psychopathic group, they said at the beginning, in order to get the people to support these invasions, we will need a new Pearl Harbor. They said that.
And yes, they did.
For them, that's like, that's not a big deal for us. We can do that. You know, that wasn't written into the PNAC, but that's, I'm sure, what is unsaid. We can do that.
Well, I would like nothing better than to see Dick Cheney, Bill Kristol, Don Rumsfeld. I'm trying to think who else. Jeb Bush,
Wolfowitz,
and Pearl.
They should all be charged with
signatories. I'd like nothing better to see them in a chain gang on one of those prison buses. That whole group, and I'm not kidding in one bit. I don't say that to sensationalize anything. I think that's what they deserve. And I would delight in seeing that. I absolutely would.
I can think of no more deserving people than what we have right now.
No, certainly not. You know, I was just reminded a few minutes ago. I was going through some of the literature that I brought back from the Take Back America conference, and there was this chain gang they had there. I wish everybody could have seen it. We tried to describe it on the air, Bruce and I, as best we could, but they were actually dressed in black and white striped prison suits, and had on the plastic modeled heads of Cheney and Bush and Rice and Wolfowitz, and it was fabulous. And I thought, you know, what justice that would be.
Indeed it would. Indeed it would. Do what you can to bring it about, Guy. It's going to be so tough.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's a tough road to hoe, as we used to say down on the farm. Hey, don't forget, Brad Friedman's going to be along with us about 4 o'clock today, 4:05, I think.
I will be listening.
And all right.
I see you signed in at the chat.
Yeah.
Okay, bro.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye now. Yeah, don't forget that. Brad Friedman's going to be along with us. And I'm anxious to ask him. I know it's maybe beyond his purview, but I would like to know if he knows anything about what this FBI, supposedly our FBI interference into the election in Mexico. I wonder. You know, if you, and I'm sure all of you that are listening to the program right now, you're just not casual listeners. You didn't just come upon this program by happenstance. You tuned in on it, and, you know, you did it deliberately, so it's your fault. It wasn't an accident. It's not like terrestrial radio. My goodness, I can't talk today. It's not like terrestrial radio where you're driving down the road and you hit the scan button and you come across the station. Well, I think I'll listen to this a while. No. When you listen to an internet program, you have intended to listen to that program. You went there deliberately, and that's how it works. And therefore, sometimes it's not as much fun, but because we don't get those surprises like we would always get on terrestrial radio, where you never knew that the next phone call wasn't going to be some, you know, foaming at the mouth crazy right winger just going off. And I really enjoyed those a lot. Call me weird, but I did enjoy those a lot. Let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Yeah, this is Harlan Owen. I'm supposed to be on with you at 3:30.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
You want
okay.
Me to hang on or what?
Pardon me.
You want me to hang on? Or you want?
Yeah,
to
just hang on. We'll be right back with you. Yeah, we're going to take a break right now. And don't go away.
Peter said to Paul, you know all those words we wrote are just the rules of the game, and the rules are the first to go. Now talking to God is Laurel begging Hardy for a gun. I got a girl in the war, man, I wonder what it is we've done. Paul said to Petey, you gotta rock yourself a little harder. Pretend the dove from above is a dragon and your feet are on fire. Got a girl in the war, Paul, the only thing I know to do. Turn up the music and pray that she makes it through. Because the keys to the kingdom got locked inside the kingdom. And the angels fly around in there, but we can't see them. Got a girl in the war, Paul, I know that they can hear me yell. If they can't find a way to help her, they can go to hell. If they can't find a way to help her, they can go to hell. Thank you. all said to Pete, you gotta rock yourself a little harder. Pretend the dove from above is a dragon and your feet are on fire. But I got a girl in the war, all her eyes are like champagne. They sparkle bubble over in the morning, all you got is rain. They sparkle bubble over in the morning, all you got is rain. Sparkle bubble over and in the morning all you got is rain.
We're back. Yes, we are. And I don't often make, as you know, I'm almost perfect on this program, and we hardly ever make mistakes. But I've done something along the way. Anyway, I didn't tell you about a guest that we're going to have on right today, and someone I know you're going to enjoy. I've been Googling around a little bit here during the break, and we've got Mr. Harlan Ullman along with us, and he's written a book called America's Promise Restored, and I'm going to let him tell you about it. But I also want to tell my listeners, and I know a lot of you are going to be shocked, he does some writing for the Washington Times. How about that? I think this is the first gentleman we've ever had on the program that wrote for the Washington Times. So, Harlan, are you with us?
Guy, thank you very much. My column in the Times, which comes out Wednesdays, is called Owls and Eagles. It is a takeoff on Hawks and Doves, and I regard myself as a radical centrist. So,
a radical centrist.
You bet. You bet. Both parties are far too extreme for my taste, and they're helping to ruin the nation, which is one of the sub-themes of my book.
Who else would you call a radical centrist?
They're hard to find.
I would say so.
I will tell you that, as you asked me, the inspiration for my book really came from Tom Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, in which Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And in my judgment, our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness are in substantial jeopardy over the long term because our government is broken. I also will quote from the Declaration that when government, quote, becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government. My book doesn't call for revolution. It calls for restoration and argues further that one of the problems is that the difficulties and challenges that we face have never been greater. They are in huge, huge numbers, which marks a radical difference from the past. So therefore, with a government that's broken and a huge array of problems at home and abroad that need to be fixed, that is why we are at jeopardy.
Well, now I know you said you're a radical centrist, and so that tells me that you don't have any particular love for either one of the parties.
That's correct.
Right now, I'm having a bit of difficulty myself. I've been a Democrat my entire life. I'm still a Democrat, hanging on to that from what I think the party used to be, not what it is now. I'm disappointed with where my party is going, and I've always voted Democrat, but I'm not happy with the direction we're taking either, and I know a lot of people aren't, and that seems to be, well, this coming election is going to be very telling, I think, if the people can get the proper information that they need to make a proper choice instead of doing it with sound bites and so forth.
Well, Guy, I will tell you that in 1988-92, I voted for George Herbert Walker Bush. And in 2004, I voted for John Kerry, whom I supported and who's a very, very good friend of mine. But I've got some bad news for you. I'm afraid that if things don't change radically, no matter who wins in November this year, the one loser is going to be the American public, because if the Republicans win, it's going to be government as usual. And if the Democrats win, given the adversarial nature and partisan politics in Washington, they're going to be out on a vendetta. Their job is going to be to discredit George Bush and fight back after 6 years of being in the wilderness. And so either way, I'm not optimistic, regardless of who wins the election, as to what this is going to do to the country.
Well, I've said all along here in the past few months that handing this government over right now is going to be akin to the captain of the Titanic smacking the iceberg and telling the assistant captain, "Hey, take over for me." That's where I think we're at right now. It's going to be difficult. I don't know. How do you see? I mean, what path do you see out of this? First of all, do you have any good suggestions for
absolutely
ending the partisanship?
If people go out and look at America's Promise Restored, I have got six big ideas, and I'd like to float those with you because I think you're going to find them to be really quite interesting. First, we have to reengage the public. Unfortunately, as you know, Guy, both political parties are too focused on their extremes and on interest group of the hard left and the hard right. So how about mandatory universal voting? That means all Americans would be required, who are eligible, to go to the polls or send in absentee ballots. Now, whether they vote for anybody or not, that's up to them. But people have got to go, and they've got to express their view about what they want in terms of their government. Now, most Americans are going to say, gee, I don't want to be forced to do anything. But you are forced to sign up, for example, for the draft. You have to register. You're forced to pay taxes. There are a lot of mandatory issues here. And so I think this would really have a revolutionary change on American politics. I think most Americans, because they've got great common sense and decency, would really want to study what the issues are, and I think they would become far more informed. Second, and you'll laugh at this, we have to restore accountability to government. It's just not the case. And here's a testing question I hope that you would pose to your listeners and to members of Congress. First, when is the time or the last time any member of Congress has read and understood a bill before he or she voted on it. And the answer is never. And the reason is because bills are just not simply written before people vote on it. Now, members of Congress saying we're too busy, we understand, you know, the bills, et cetera, et cetera. But if you were a chief executive officer of any company, it would be against the law for you to do work that way. And so while this is symbolic and it's a mean of shaming of members of Congress, unless the public really demands accountability, we're not going to get it. And I'm afraid that your prescription of where we're headed is exactly where we're going to go.
Well,
wow.
I want to go back to the first one for a minute. You were going to have mandatory voting.
Sure.
I like the mandatory voting idea, and especially like if we're going to go to the polls, I'd like to have it on a mandatory Saturday.
On a couple of days, not just one.
Yeah, Saturday. That would be fine as well. I'd also like to get rid of all the electronic voting machines and just make sure that we have, because I don't think people are very, I don't think there's a lot of confidence anymore in what's happening in the polls. In fact, a little later on today, we're having a gentleman on to talk about that very thing, an expert on it. But if we're going to demand that everybody vote, how are we going to make sure that, I think most of the people that don't vote now just don't give a damn.
I don't think so. No, I mean, only 52% voted in the last election. I think a lot of people feel it doesn't make any difference. What does one vote mean? Government's going to do what they want. I got my own problems. And that's understandable. But here's a couple of ideas that I think that are important to remember. First, in 1789, when we established as a nation, the only people who could vote were white, male, property owners. It took us nearly 130, and by the way, they still didn't elect a president directly. We still don't. They didn't elect Senate. They only voted for members of the House of Representatives. It took 130 years for women to get the vote, and a lot of people argue, gee, women should not get the vote. It took an additional 40 or 50 years before minorities really had the opportunity to vote. So we've been moving towards gradual enfranchisement of all qualified citizens who can vote. So I think that moves in the direction. And as far as incentives and disincentives, you get a credit for your mortgage interest payments. If you're a farmer and you don't plant wheat or corn or whatever it is, you get a subsidy. So why not the first time that you vote under the system, you get a $100 tax credit? And if you don't vote, then why aren't you not made to take a civics course and do public service because you failed to vote, and this will force you to learn what the system of democracy is all about? So I think there are ways that we really can popularize this, incentivize this, and I think because if it were to be implemented, people had a vote, I think you'd see school systems returning to teaching civics and basic things that our citizens need to know but are just not really being taught in our school systems today.
Well, I can certainly agree with you on that. I think the civics in school anymore and government classes are, well, they're almost non-existent. All right, so we're gonna make people vote. We're gonna demand that they vote. We're going to give them a tax credit, actually, for voting.
First time, you bet.
First time, and we're going to do our best to make sure that they're informed voters. That's
right.
Very important. I've always said I'd like to take the money out of politics completely.
This will do that, in a sense, because
yes.
How do both the Republican and Democratic parties organize for elections? They're going to go to their base. Bush goes to the 22% of the Republicans who are conservative Christians, and Kerry went to the more extreme left-wing members of his party who had money and who had the interest groups. He had to rally these. If you had mandatory voting, you would probably increase the voting population from 120 million to 200 million. You'd bring in a lot of centrist Americans, and that's what I think is really important. America operates best when it moves from the center, and that's going to require Americans to be engaged in this, in my view.
Well, has that been the problem? You know, I like to hearken back to when I was a kid. I worked in the first Kennedy campaign. That was my first exposure, and you know, the Young Democrats Club, and when the election went back and forth, and there was a little rancor on each side, not a lot, and when it was all over with, everybody shook hands and said, hey, let's get on with the business of governing the United States. There wasn't the terrible divisiveness that there is now. Certainly, I think that's probably one of the things you want to do is get us back to that where we're
absolutely.
We're more into governing than we are fighting about, our partisan issues.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, Richard Nixon, to his credit, this is Richard Nixon of Watergate and everything else, finally conceded to Jack Kennedy because even though he could have contested Illinois and Cook County and possibly could have won, felt that would have been terribly disruptive to the United States. That same sentiment obviously did not apply in 2000 with Gore versus Bush.
Right.
And I think that's reflective. And really what's happened, Guy, is that after the Kennedy years, I mean, a combination of Vietnam, of Watergate, of all these excesses have made government far more partisan, and they have really had destructive impact on it. And so here we are, where we are being whipped by the worst excesses of culture crusade and partisanship. And what I mean by that, culture, as you pointed out, has changed the focus of politics from governing to a continual campaign to either win election or discredit the opposition on whatever issue you may want to use, using attack ads and really scurrilous attacks on both sides that defy the face of facts and reality and just use whatever people think is the thing that they want to support rather than what should be done.
Well, I happen to think that over the past, I don't know, 25 or 30 years or so, that I've watched while the conservative side has built themselves a great political machine, and they were very deliberate in doing so. They built it brick by brick from the ground up with a great foundation. And pretty much the liberals, the Democrats, sit on the other side and watched them do it, thinking, well, I wonder what they're up to. And the Democrats, I think, have fallen tremendously behind as a result of that. We don't have a media presence, in my opinion. We don't have the media presence that the people on the right do.
Yep.
There's been, well, let me give an example. It being the radical centrist that you are, I can ask you this question, and you will probably have an answer for it for me, and maybe I won't agree with it, but I'd like to hear your opinion. If I say Tom DeLay on the right, who do you say on the left?
On the left, in terms of extremism, I would say, let me answer your question this way. I would take a look at the leadership of the House. Quite frankly, however good they may be as individual people, I don't want to see Denny Hassert, I don't want to see Bill Frist, I don't want to see Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi or John Boehner, and especially not Tom DeLay, in the positions they are, because quite frankly, I think they lack the depth and the gravitas of previous people in Congress. That is part of the problem.
Well, I think you and I'd get along very well.
I'd also like to make another point. My column next Wednesday is going to bring in with that great American humorist Will Rogers' observation, I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah.
And what it's going to do, the Democrats in town, the elitists on the Hill, are trying to seize national security as the issue from the Republicans, in which they are going to fail, unfortunately. The issue they should be seizing is government is broken. Here's how we're going to fix it in the area of national defense, homeland security, and one or two other areas. But they won't. They're out to attack the Republicans from every manner of means. And unfortunately, the Republicans are much smarter. Karl Rove is very, very clever. They're going to turn this into an issue of patriotism, and they're going to turn it into not a referendum but a choice. And at this stage, if I had to make a bet, my guess is that Republicans will narrowly, things don't change, retain control of both houses.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you. I'm not terribly optimistic. I've told many of, I speak to many of the Democratic clubs here in Southwest Florida, and everybody's got this air about them right now that, oh boy, I can't wait till fall because,
yep.
And I think they're overconfident because, as we used, you know, as they say, there people are fond of saying, you ain't seen nothing yet. I think the big guns will come out soon, and they will take the national security issue right away from the Democrats. Well, I mean, I have to face it. The Democrats haven't shown a lot of backbone on that issue anyway.
Oh, they haven't, and unfortunately, neither has the Congress on both sides. I mean, Congress has been absent without leave, if you're gentle, and derelict, if you come from my position in terms of oversight. And this applies to both houses and to both parties. I mean, I find it irresponsible. In the case, for example, of the FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and all this kind of intrusion, government has a responsibility to do this, but government has a responsibility for oversight. And the fact that neither Republicans nor Democrats could come out fighting and say, this is nonsense, I find to be absolutely outrageous. I mean, the only person who's really shown backbone on these issues, to me, is John McCain and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina on the issue of torture and treatment of enemy combatants. But beyond that, both houses of Congress have been dead in the water, and that is particularly outrageous. And unless the public demands more, that's what we're going to get, and we are headed in, unfortunately, very perilous directions. North Korea is the greatest single new example. We have an opportunity here. Take Kim on. Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea, provided we use international support. And right now, if we persist in the UN to have a resolution that's not going to be supported 15-0, we are going to lose that support, much as we lost it after September 11th, when we allowed to dissipate this tremendous international support for us after those terrible attacks. This is the way we're going, and you know, we have so many opportunities, so many ways to make things better, but because the system is broken, in my judgment, we're going to fail in those opportunities, and you can bet that you will see us turn this Korean problem into a U.S.-North Korean confrontation, which is the stupidest thing we can do. This should be an international confrontation with North Korea in which we are part. But I will bet you a huge amount of money it's not going to turn out that way.
Well, I agree. First of all, Russia and China, I don't think, are about to join in on that. It doesn't appear that...
Oh, they are. No, they will. I mean, the resolution that they will support is condemnation. They just don't want to impose any further sanctions. And what other sanction can we possibly impose on North Korea? If you're going to cut off food and electricity, who's going to take it on the chin? It's not going to be Kim Jong-il. It's not going to be the leadership. It's going to be the North Korean people. So what we have here is a great opportunity. And I mean, I actually sketched some of these things out in my book, America's Promise Restored, in terms of a framework for dealing with it. But Kim, by this marvelous display of World War II and 1950s technology and his missile firing, helped celebrate our 4th of July and George Bush's 60th birthday, has really put himself in a position where the international community now can force him to do one of two things: either cooperate and carry out the six-party talks to forego nuclear weapons, or isolate himself. And if we have the international community behind us, we can isolate him. Containment and deterrence will work, provided we have Russia and China and the UN behind us. I mean, this does not take a rocket scientist to understand, but I'm afraid, because we are going to demand harsher verbal responses, which have no real effect in any event, we're going to lose this opportunity, much as we lost the opportunity in the Middle East after September 11th to change the world.
Well, now, the Chinese have been, I guess it's well known, the Chinese have been helping feed them for quite a long time.
With good reason.
Yes. But now I understand that Kim Jong-il is, well, a little bit on the bad side of the Chinese leadership right now. I read the other day a story. I didn't know whether to laugh or not when I read it. He's been keeping their trains. They send train loads of food in, and he's been keeping the trains because his own trains, are railroad trains, are so dilapidated that he needs them, and he's been keeping them, not sending them back.
So, that's a great story, Guy, but you really don't want to provoke a country with 1.2 billion people.
Yeah.
And that's not really smart. But even here with China, I propose a solution in my book about Korea. China has been helpful. It's been supportive because it doesn't want to see North Korea disintegrate, millions of refugees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But China can be much more influential. Question is, how can we incentivize? And there's a very simple answer. It's called Taiwan. Now, I'm not talking about selling Taiwan down the river. What I'm saying is taking Taiwanese independence off the table permanently. We can tolerate two Chinas, but let's just forget this notion of independence. If you go to China, and I was there a year ago, and actually spoke to some of the most senior Chinese leadership about this, the single most important hot-butt issue that surpasses anything in the United States, you know, however you may stand on single-sex marriages, flag burning, Iraq, the war on terror, this hot-button issue is Taiwanese independence. The Chinese are irrational, viscerally, from the Chinese in the street to President Hu Jintao about this issue. We can take it off the table because if China can deliver, North Korea will say, we'll agree to the six-party talks arrangement, we'll forego nuclear weapons, we'll do all these things because it's in our best interest. Then what we would say is, great, we will announce publicly that if China were to invade or attack Taiwan without provocation, we will, of course, defend Taiwan. But if Taiwan were to announce its independence, without any kind of provocation, all bets are off, meaning Taiwan would keep its mouth shut about independence. There would be, you know, decades before there would be integration. But that is such a hugely important issue to the Chinese that I believe that would be a sufficient incentive to get them to move forward with North Korea. And if North Korea proved truculent, then we have a clear and present danger, and I think the international community would stay bound together to contain and deter them. If we did it with the Soviet Union, that was a major superpower, we can do it with a country that's a pygmy power.
Do you think that there really is a possibility of a military conflict with the?
No, I think there's obviously some probability, but Kim Jong-il knows a couple of things. If there's a war, he's going to lose it. And in if there is a war, there will be hundreds of thousands and probably a million or so Korean casualties on both sides of the DMZ. Seoul is within artillery range of the DMZ. There are some 10,000 artillery pieces that North Korea has, plus an army of some 1 million men. Whether they would use chemical weapons, I do not know. But Kim also knows that if he were to attack, he would be defeated, he would be destroyed, he would be out of power. And I think he appreciates that that is a kind of limiting constraint on him. I don't think he's stupid. I think he's crazy like a fox. This is somebody who may have been raised in an environment in which he believes he is the supremo above all supremos, but he still has interest, and ruling that country is one of those interests, and I think that interest would certainly prove to be the most rational reason why conflict would probably, in almost all circumstances, there are some that maybe will be avoided.
Well, can't you equate some of that to Saddam Hussein?
Yes and no. Actually, Saddam Hussein really thought the largest threat to his regime was not the United States, but was internal rebellion. And in fact, he had deployed his so-called Fedayeen Saddam, these were the sort of paramilitary troops, out to the hustings, not to defend against an American attack, but to defend against an internal rebellion. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Saddam did not destroy any of the bridges and motorways when the war started, which he would have thought he would have done, because he was more afraid of rebellion that he would have to put down, an assault from beyond. So you had a fundamental misperception here. I don't think Kim is necessarily worried about a fundamental revolution at home. I suspect he's probably more rational than Saddam was in some ways, but I think he thoroughly understands if there's going to be a war, he's going to lose it.
Yes, yes. Well, you mentioned six proposals in your book, and we've talked
right.
about two.
Number three is we have to deal with civil liberties and human rights, and the excesses that created Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. As I mentioned earlier, and I spell this out in great detail in the book, there's always going to be a tension between national security and civil liberties. But the one way to assure that that is kept in balance is through oversight. Now, I don't care whether the oversight is by Congress or the judiciary or both, but I don't want any executive branch or any president, irrespective of party, whoever that person may well be, to use their judgment alone to determine what they can do and what they can't do in imposing on our civil liberties. And to support that, I have recommended, and the 9/11 Commission has adopted, the notion of having an independent commission confirmed by the Senate on civil liberties, human rights, and national security, which would be there to make sure that this was kept in balance. It would function much as the Federal Reserve and the Securities and Exchange Commission's function as independent agencies to keep balance in place. This would be one way of safeguarding those liberties. And second, you may recall that during the Korean War, many of our prisoners of war were brainwashed and were turned against the country. And so as a result, we adopted the so-called code of conduct, how the military would behave under very difficult circumstances of captivity. Now, any number of our POWs during the Vietnam War admitted what a great boon the code of conduct was. We need a government-wide code of conduct for dealing with the so-called war on terror and how we deal with enemy combatants, how we deal with all these people. It's got to apply to all branches, not just the Department of Defense, but to the CIA, to intelligence, the State Department, to Customs, to Treasury, to anybody who has any kind of interaction. Because if we don't have that kind of transparent standard like the code of conduct was after the Korean War, we're going to see these excessive, and these excesses are unbelievably devastating to our image and to the vision that the Americans try to project as upholders of freedom, democracy, and liberty. What's happened at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo, what's happened with these single-figured instances of Americans possibly killing and probably of killing Iraqis and murdering them or whatever, has been unbelievably destructive to our reputation abroad. And it really is a recruiting poster for people who want to join the terrorists or the insurgents who want to oppose the United States. We have got to fix it.
It'll be decades until we can erase a lot of that, I'm sure.
More than that, but the point is, let's move forward with a code of conduct. It worked in
yes.
Korea. Why can't it work today?
Yes, we have to show the world, not only the people of this country, we have to show the world. That's probably the most devastating part of all this to me. I live in an area where I meet a great many people from outside of this country, and the impressions I'm hearing of them, of our country, these days from people, mostly Europeans, it makes me sad as an American. It really does.
It is, and it's a tragedy in many ways. It's a disgrace. You know, obviously you're going to have excesses in war. In Vietnam, where I fought, We had My Lai. I spent a lot of time on the Cape Penangan Peninsula where My Lai is located, though I was there a couple of years before the atrocity. Those things happen. Some of them are just not unavoidable for any number of reasons. However, Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib and our treatment of enemy combatants largely was avoidable had we had oversight.
Yes. Harlan, we're coming up to the top of the hour right now, and I want to thank you so much. Give us all the information you can here in about 30 seconds of your book, where we can get it, and the title again, and a website we can go visit and all.
It's America's Promise Restored, Preventing Culture, Crusade, and Partisanship from Wrecking Our Nation. It's available at bookstores. You can get it through Amazon.com. And if you want to go to my publisher's website, it's Avalon, A-V-A-L-O-N, Pub, and the imprint is Carolyn Graff, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, and Graff, G-R-A-F. And people can Google me on website to see where I've been and what I've done. But it's a book I hope that many Americans read. I hope they debate the issues of mandatory voting, of imposing accountability on government, and the four other recommendations, the big ideas that I have, because the only way we're going to get our democracy back and follow what Tom Jefferson said about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is for Americans to engage. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to repeat what our founding fathers did in 1776, today in 2006.
Harlan, thank you so very much for being on the program today. I really enjoyed our discourse, and we'll promote that book and get all this out after you're gone. So.
Well, thank you, and I'm sure you're surprised that you could say I actually liked having somebody from the Washington Times aboard.
I got to admit, it's you're absolutely right.
Good for you guys.
Harlan Ullman, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Harlan.
Thank you. Bye.
And it's time for the news at the top of the hour. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this.
This is the Quality News Network. In New Jersey, Reuters reports that the president of the state Senate says he expects a state budget deal to be reached today that will allow Atlantic City's casinos to reopen and 45,000 state employees to return to work. The state has been in partial shutdown since the new fiscal year began last Saturday without a budget in place. The space shuttle Discovery has docked successfully with the International Space Station, where Discovery will remain for the rest of its mission, and where one of Discovery's team, a German astronaut, is joining the space station crew for the next 6 months. The United Nations Security Council has resumed debate on a draft resolution condemning North Korea's missile launches earlier this week. The draft also calls for sanctions against Pyongyang, but Russia and China are opposed to the idea of sanctions. They prefer diplomacy instead. Meanwhile, North Korea says it plans to test launch even more missiles, claiming they are needed for its defense. There is no declared winner in Mexico's presidential election yet, but the count is just about complete, and conservative Felipe Calderon has built an insurmountable lead. His opponent, Andres Miguel Lopez Obrador, says he will challenge the results in federal court. Less than 200,000 votes out of more than 41 million cast separate the two. Two state rulings against gay marriage today. New York's highest court says it is not allowed under current state law, and Georgia's Supreme Court has reinstated that state's ban on gay marriage. A Texas court has ruled that despite the fact that he's withdrawn from the race, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's name must remain on the November ballot in his congressional district. Republicans wanted to replace him with another candidate. More violence in Iraq. A dozen Iranians, pilgrims to a Shiite Muslim shrine in Kufa, were killed today, 40 injured when their buses were attacked by a suicide car bomber. After being snubbed by the Pentagon, a congressional committee has ordered Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to turn over documents on the investigation into abuse at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. He has until July 14th to comply. Informal talks between Iran and the European Union, postponed yesterday, are taking place tonight in Belgium. But formal talks about Iran's nuclear program have been delayed until next Tuesday. And even then, Iran says it will not be prepared to give its answer to the EU offer of incentives in exchange for a halt to its nuclear program. Israel has increased its offensive in Gaza, where 12 Palestinian militants were killed today, and where Israel is setting up a buffer zone in the northern Gaza Strip in an effort to stop Palestinian militants from firing rockets into Israel. And a new study finds that very premature infants, those weighing less than 2 pounds, 3 ounces, who are fed with breast milk in the hospital, do better on tests of mental development later in life than those who are given only formula. Business news is next.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
New claims for unemployment benefits fell last week to 313,000, down 2,000. Mortgage applications were up last week by 5.9%, and Freddie Mac reports that 30-year fixed-rate mortgage rates were also up by 1/100th of a point to 6.79%. Southwest Airlines is raising its one-way fares $3 to $10, but only on flights longer than 750 miles, the reason higher fuel costs. Three people have been charged in federal court with stealing confidential information from Coca-Cola, including a sample of a new drink, and then trying to sell it to Pepsi. Once they approached Pepsi, Pepsi called Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola called the FBI, which launched an undercover investigation. AOL is considering the idea of transforming itself into an ad-supported internet access provider like Yahoo or Google, rather than a fee-based provider, and in doing so would start giving away its services to customers who already have high-speed internet service. Microsoft will start selling a wireless digital music and video player at Christmas to compete with Apple's iPod. The new player will let users download music and videos over the air. And GM's board meets tomorrow to talk about a proposed three-way alliance with Nissan and Renault, but the Wall Street Journal reports that there will be some opposition to the idea by those who consider it a hostile move against management. Light Sweet crude oil is trading at $75.10 a barrel this hour. It's down 9 cents. Dow Industrials are up 73 points, and NASDAQ is up 4, and the S&P 500 is also up 4 points. More at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, back with you. We're a few seconds behind. I'm ran over a little bit with that interview, and the news started a little bit late, so we're just a few seconds behind. So glad to have all of you with us this afternoon. I found that to be a fascinating interview. Who would have thought... And I guess some of you have guessed by now that that I was a little bit blindsided with that. We thought that was scheduled for another day. But anyway, it came off good. Harlan Ullman writes for the Washington Times. And he didn't sound like a Washington Times writer, did he? I didn't think so. I thought he made a lot of sense and fascinating. So I'm going to make it a point to send for his book. I think I would like it. Welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us. Those of you sitting over there in the Head On Radio Network chat room, hi to everybody there. The folks over at the Tom Hartman chat room, hello to you. The folks at Democratic Underground, hi. Democrats.com, SmirkingChimp.com, and a whole list of others. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show. As promised, I promise you Brad Friedman is going to be along with us, and I'll probably discuss this right in front of you. We talked about a while back making a weekly segment on this. What do you think? Let us know what you think. And I think it'd be a good thing to have Brad on every week if he can swing it. And I know he's heading on vacation pretty soon for a little while. At least that was his plan. But, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men and all that. So we'll talk to him about it. Hey, Brad, are you with us?
I am, Guy. How are you?
I'm great. Are you still planning on that vacation?
Yeah, I'm still planning on it. I tell you, last time I tried to do that last year, I think I got about 2 days up into the mountains, off the grid, and then I made the mistake of turning on a little scratchy transistor radio, heard Rush Limbaugh lying about Cindy Sheehan, and said to my girlfriend in my tent, Des, we got to figure out how to get to Texas and broadcast from the middle of that cow pasture.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, how are we going to do that? I said, I don't know. We'll figure it out on the drive. So we ended up driving down to Crawford, Texas, and broadcasting from there for about 2 weeks straight. That was the last vacation I had. It wasn't much of a vacation. So now I'm going to try again this year.
You know, I was there right before you were there.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, and did my show. So I've got to ask, it begs the question. You know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
What a hell of a place for a vacation.
Yeah, right.
Whoa.
I mean, literally 110 degrees in the shade there, working around the clock. We were broadcasting some 8-9 hours a day, and, I mean, it was great. I wouldn't trade the experience for the world. But you're right, not much of a vacation, and I tell you, I need one badly, especially before we get to this November train wreck that's coming up around the bend.
Man, it's coming fast, too. It's really coming. Just one more question. Where'd you set up? At the Peace House there, or did you go out to Camp Casey?
Yeah, we were actually down there in Camp Casey.
Okay.
From the big tent. We broadcast a couple of the days up at the Peace House. But we were able to work with the folks down there who got an internet connection right down there at the in Camp Casey 2, and they got we were able to broadcast out of there with broadband most of the time. Occasionally, it would go down when we'd have wind storms, particularly as Hurricane Katrina had come in right at the very end there. That really knocked us out. But we did our best to stay up on the air and tell some of the extraordinary stories that were going on down there from the ground, and it was a nice change of pace, I think, from the, you know, sort of the CNN the hit piece, two-minute packages that they'd come in, misrepresent what was going on, and so we told the real story of what was going on there. I think we broadcast some 50-something hours of live radio right there from the ground. It was pretty cool.
Well, it was an interesting time, and we suffered the malady of having them actually hack our phone line from the Peace House when we were there doing the broadcast.
Yeah, no, I know. We had that same problem, actually, because the phone box is right out there on Main Street,
mm-hmm.
And I think we had managed to actually get John Conyers on the line. John Conyers and Ariana had called in, and I think in both cases, right after we got them online, boom, a minute later, they were knocked out. So it was, boy, I mean, every minute down there was quite a challenge to stay up and on the air, but I think it was all worth it. Not easy, though, that's for sure, as you well know.
Oh, yeah, they were having a blood drive. I can't remember if it was the Moose or Elk Club down there, you know, downtown there. If you went, you had the big green elevator there on the left side of the road. If you were anyway,
right.
There's either a Moose or an Elks Club there in the big old brick building, and they were having a blood drive the day I was there. And so I give blood, and I had several hours until showtime, so I went by and I said, I'll sign up. And he said, where are you from? And I said, Florida. And he said, you with those people? And I said, those people. He said, well, that Sheehan bunch down there, are you with them? I said, well, I'm not actually officially with them. I'm here to cover the story. And the guy looked me square in the eye and said, we don't want your Yankee blood.
And wow.
Welcome to Crawford, Texas.
Wow. From Florida, you got Yankee blood, huh?
Yeah. Right. You got it.
Yeah, they were kind of confused down there. I mean, it was extraordinary, you know, seeing all these guys running by with their, you know, support the troops signs that they were, you know, flashing to one Iraq-Afghanistan vet after another who were there supporting Cindy Sheehan. So, I mean, it was an extraordinary moment in time, and, you know, to see these guys running by who had never fought a day in their lives yelling at actual troops,
yeah,
telling them to support the troops. I mean, it was just bizarre.
I was lucky enough to be there when Mike Gallagher arrived with his, you know, the talk show guy, Gallagher.
Right.
He arrived with a busload of guys, and they got out, and Gallagher stood across from Camp Casey with his little bullhorn and was yelling things at him. And so I accosted him about that later. I thought it was a disgraceful display.
It certainly was, and I've got some pictures still at bradblog.com where I've got, for example, after a lot of the media had left on those final days because Katrina had rolled in,
mm-hmm.
Of course, Bush and Rove were still in town, and I've got photographs of Karl Rove coming by to that camp you're talking about across the street from Camp Casey that the wing nuts called Camp Reality, ironically enough. And there's Rove, glad-handing, taking pictures, posing, smiling, even at the very moment that New Orleans was drowning.
Well, amazing stories from there. And I called him.
Yeah.
And he denied ever doing that. Denied it. I said, wait a minute. I was there. I saw you get out with the bullhorn and start chanting, anti-slogans against it. I saw you do it. No, never happened. Well, okay for you. Well, anyway, that's not what I call to talk about. I'm sure we could swap stories about that for a long, long time.
We sure could.
Interesting place, folks, but I would not recommend it as a vacation mecca anytime soon.
Well, let me say this. I would recommend that people head on down there again because they are headed down there for Camp Casey this summer, I think in the next week or two. They're going to be there for a few weeks, and then they're moving it all to the mall in D.C., I think from September 7 through 21 or something like that. It's an experience like none other, whether it's Camp Casey down in Crawford or Camp Democracy, as they're calling it out in D.C., and I would recommend people get down there and support some extraordinary people. Some miracles really happened, and if you have just 30 seconds here, one of the stories that has not been told about Camp Casey was...
We got all day, Brad.
What's that?
We got all day. We got till 5 o'clock.
Okay. Well, one of the amazing things that I was there for, and... I think almost nobody else was on that final night of Camp Casey before everyone left. There was a candlelight vigil at the original Camp Casey there, and I was one of the couple of folks, myself and another a vet there. I'm not a vet, but he was a vet. We walked across the street to the supposed Camp Reality, and there was just a handful of folks left, and we invited them to participate in this, nonpartisan candlelight vigil. And they wanted to know, could they bring their flag, their American flag? We said, of course. And I was one of the folks who helped carry that flag across. And the sheriff's office had to get permission to let them cross to come over to the Camp Casey side. And they called in, and the sheriff said, well, if they want to get together, then sure, let them. And they actually walked across that no man's land that you may remember.
Because
the camp there. And... had a beautiful candlelight vigil to remember the troops who had been killed, and all the media, for the most part, was gone,
of course.
It was just the two groups coming together and having what was really one of the only peaceful, sane moments, I believe, that entire time. And of course, none of the media was there, which is perhaps why it was able to happen in the first place.
Well, you're right. I was in one little situation. You remember down there where the Peace House was, if you're looking at the front of it to the right, there was that street beside it there, and you took it to the end, and you went down to their little football stadium that was there in town. And they were had a big rally the day I was there, and the Freebers were there. And I got to tell you, it was a motley crew. My, oh, my. There was about 20 of them, I would say.
Yeah, that was that big Saturday when all
And so I decided I'd like to interview these guys. Some lady that drove me over there, she was an attorney from San Antonio, and anyway, she drove me. I got treated like a king there. I had a bunch of Guy James Show listeners meet me in Dallas, and we all went to a Mexican restaurant and had a good time. But anyway, went down to there, and I saw all those Freepers there, and I said, I have to interview these Freepers. I mean, I've got to interview these Freepers. And so I said, who's the spokesman here? I'd like to, and they said, why? I said, well, I'd like to get you on your radio, I want to put you on the show. And so they started an argument amongst themselves who was going to do the talking. And after about 5 minutes, they couldn't come to a consensus of who was going to talk, and it just kind of all blew up. But they were so well-spoken that I, it was quite a bunch.
Well, we went out of our way. We invited those guys to come on, and they said they would, and it really wasn't until almost the, I think it was second or third to last day there, where we finally got them. We were able to devote an entire show, I think 4 or 5 hours one of those afternoons, to folks who supported the war, who were supporting Bush's position, you know, to try to give them a voice, to look, tell the stories, you know, enough with the propaganda for one side or another, but tell people's point of view and have a legitimate debate, which ended up occurring down there in Crawford, a debate of some legitimacy, at least, that should have happened, you know, 3 years earlier before
sure.
you got into the war.
Sure.
But at least
sure.
we were having it to a certain extent then, and I think to that end it was very valuable, and we've been able to actually have a bit of a debate about it since then. Prior to that, you know, you couldn't talk about it.
No, definitely so. There were some mean times around
yep.
that time, very mean. Brad, of course, we didn't invite you on to talk about that today, but it's interesting to share thoughts with you over it. I don't know personally a lot of people that were there, and it was an experience I'll never forget, certainly. And I did listen to some of your programs. I had a chance to while you were there. I'm trying to think. One last thing here.
Yeah.
You must have been there when the guy took all the drove the truck through and took all the crosses down.
I was. I think I arrived there just after.
Just
that.
After.
I
okay.
Heard about it. Yeah.
Okay. Because I know
when the guy had done that, and then I think it wasn't that around the same time that some guy shot off a some rounds of weapons.
Mm-hmm. One of the landowners up the road there on the right hand side.
Yeah, that he was practicing for dove season.
Yes.
Which is an interesting turn of phrase, given what was going on down there.
Well, everybody, head to your local travel agency and book a trip to Crawford, Texas. I'm sure you'll love it. You get to see Waco and beautiful Dallas-Fort Worth area and all that. I'm sure you'll love it.
Bring shorts.
shorts, off, flashlights. What else did everybody have?
Sunscreen and water.
Yeah, sunscreen and water. The people in Dallas... I had a rental car, and the people that met me and took me out to dinner that evening filled the whole back seat and the trunk of my car with all those things to take down Cam Casey. So they were well supplied.
They were, and people really take care of you when you get down there. I mean, they fed everyone.
Oh, yeah.
For everyone. And really, just, you know, extraordinary things. When I showed up there, and we didn't know if we could get on the air or not, people said, don't worry, Brad, relax. Miracles happen here at Cam Casey. And I was, of course, dubious, but I'll tell you, one miracle after another happened there while we were there. And so I can't recommend it enough, even though it doesn't sound like much of a vacation. It really is something you'll never forget.
All right. Hey, let's talk about voting.
Yeah.
What's the latest? How about the Busby-Bilbrey thing? Where's that going? Is it going anywhere?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I haven't even had a chance to report this yet on the blog, so I'll break some news here for you, Guy. A manual hand count request has now been filed down there in that race where, as your listeners probably know, the voting machines were sent home for days and weeks prior to the elections. They were all Diebold voting machines. They were sent home for days and weeks prior to the election with poll workers to be stored in their cars and garages, which is in defiance, really, of the brand-new laws that have been put in place at both the federal and California state level concerning these machines. As we've learned in just the past few months, the Diebold systems in particular, both optical scan and touchscreen, are incredibly hackable. In 2 minutes' time, they can be hacked with no password necessary. So it was extraordinary when these were sent home with poll workers, and it violated the certification for these systems. So the folks down in San Diego are trying to hold someone accountable down there and get a legitimate count on that election. And so several things are going to happen, the first of which is this manual hand count request, which has been filed. Interestingly enough, well, a couple of points, we're getting word back from the registrar that they can charge anything they want for this hand count, and they may charge as much as $130,000 to recount the race.
It's always something like that.
Furthermore, another interesting piece of trivia here. According to the California Election Code, you have to state on whose behalf you are filing for such a count request. The woman who filed the manual hand count request decided to file it on behalf of Brian Bilbrey, the Republican who reportedly won that race.
I see. Oh, man. Well, yep. I, this is really disconcerting, the problems that we're having with the voting in the country. And you know, it's here all these years, we've sent election inspectors to other countries, and now we need them.
Oh, we need them big time. I mean, and you know, one of the reasons there's all this focus on this Busby-Bilbrey race, it was the first federal race to really be run since these new provisions were put in place. And remember, it was essentially for the U.S. House to replace the now jailed Duke Cunningham down there in San Diego. So it was the first federal race that we've had since all of these new regulations and requirements have kicked in, this being the first year that the Help America Vote Act kicks in and sends these new, untested, unsecure, hackable voting machines out to every state and county in the union. It's remarkable, and what we are in for this November is nothing short of a meltdown, frankly, and that's why it's so important now. You know, I've told people I don't really care who won the Busby-Bilbrey election as long as it's the person who received the most votes.
That's right.
They've got to deal with the accountability issue now on this race before we see 435 of these things, plus 30-something Senate races, all happening on the same day.
Imagine
in November.
Oh, what a huge conflagration that's going to be. I got somebody here I think has a question for you. I'm going to try this. Sure. If I get us cut off, I'm going to call you back. But let's try this. Hi, you've got a question for Brad?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, go right ahead.
Do you know if Busby's office has ever offered a statement why the conception?
I do.
Also, have they counted any or all of the absentee ballots yet?
Yes, I can answer both of those questions. Busby's office, and she recently sent me a statement just prior to an emergency town hall meeting we had there last Wednesday in San Diego on this, saying that she supports my efforts and Bobby Kennedy's efforts and the Brennan Center for Justice, who recently put out a report last week on 120 threats to e-voting security. She supports our efforts for e-voting security, she says. But then she further goes on to say what she said originally when she issued a statement on this, which was that they had hundreds of folks from both parties watching the tabulation on election night, and they saw nothing unusual. Now, that's troubling because you could have a million people watching, and you would not see anything unusual if the systems were tampered with in the way we've discovered that they are tamperable. And in fact, it was down in Florida, December of 2005, when we discovered that on the Diebold Opscan machines, and an election was flipped. It had paper ballots, but while the paper ballots were accurate, the machine Opscan reported it incorrectly. And, of course, because it's Florida, it is now illegal in the state of Florida to actually count ballots that have already been counted by machine, which is really troubling.
Yes, it is.
The other question I have, that yes, as of Thursday, I think it was 5 o'clock or so last Thursday, the San Diego County Registrar has now certified that election. Mind you, Brian Bilbrey was sworn in to Congress about 3 or 4 weeks before that, while there were still many votes to be counted, and the race certainly hadn't been certified, but the GOP went ahead and swore him into Congress. So it has been certified. A manual hand count has now been filed. And I think I hit all those questions, didn't I?
Yeah. Okay. Hey, thank you. Your question been answered, Alice?
Yes. Uh-huh.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Alice.
Bye.
That's Alice from Humboldt County, California.
Yes.
I always have the California contingent on here. I don't know why. It must be something to do with the time, but we have a lot of California folks on.
I've heard her. She's called in to numerous shows when I appear around the country.
Ah, she's following you.
apparently so. I've never spoken to her directly, but apparently she must be a Brad blog reader.
Well, she is, and that one of the interesting things about Alice is the historical end of it. She's been around a long time. A long time, and yeah. You know, she voted for Roosevelt. She remembers back as far back as you want to.
And bless her. I mean, she really pays attention to these issues of electoral integrity, and boy, I wish we had a few million more Americans who did. Although I must say, the Americans, people, I think, get it for the most part. You know, Lou Dobbs had a quick poll the other day on his show. He's finally been covering this, and he said, should the voting machines be banned until the security can be ensured? And the response was 97% of the folks said yes, the machine should be banned. So the American people are getting it. It's just the political parties and the mainstream media who still, unfortunately, seem to be out to lunch on this.
Brad, do you see any problem? I understand there are problems, of course, and we're in a modern day with computers and all. But do you see any problem with going back to the old paper ballot thing, putting it in a box?
No, I don't. I mean, I think the problem that people will contend is that, it'll take a week or two to sort of manually hand count those ballots, and we're in this age where we need to know, as soon as the polls close on election night, who the winner is. I suspect, however, that if America really understands the problems with these systems, and I believe that America does understand it, then they would gladly change a delay in reporting for accuracy in reporting. So that's really the only problem, and the only reason that these machines help anybody, frankly, is the media, is for speed, so they can get the returns out quickly. And that's no way to run a democracy. So, no, I don't see a problem with that. I also, by the way, don't see a problem to using computers for elections under a bunch of ground rules, that they be transparent, that they be open, that any citizen in the world can come in and check them out, that the source code is available, and essentially, if they want to use them to print ballots, that's one thing. But when you're using them to count the vote and there's no way to track them, and they're using secret software, and it's private companies who own them, then we got a problem. And so we're a long way off, frankly, from being able to use computer systems correctly. So, something needs to be done, because I've got an article that I posted yesterday quoting from Weldon Berger over at BTC News, who says he's got some inside sources saying that the GOP plans this fall in close elections to claim e-voting fraud, and that they plan on, quoting folks like me and other, some of the Democrats who have come out on this and saying, look, these lefties out there have told us that these machines are vulnerable to fraud, so we agree, and we need to look at this race and that race. Look, the Republicans are not afraid of the same thing that the Democrats are afraid of. The Republicans are not afraid to come out and say this election was stolen. They're not afraid of being called sore losers and tinfoil hat wearers and all of that. And I think that ought to be a wake-up call to the DNC to pay attention, because I promise you, the GOP will have no problem coming out and yelling and screaming about stolen elections the way Democrats seem to fear.
Oh, I agree. I agree, and they've been so good at turning things around, and they'll turn that around too. That's why I don't think we'll ever have another election without a bunch of controversy. I don't think we ever will.
Well, not at this rate, but I'll tell you, when the RNC comes out and says that, I'm going to have to say, well, you're right.
Yeah.
And I may have a bunch of folks who read Brad Blog who are all of a sudden mad at me, but I'll tell you, I mean...
What else could you say? I mean, it's the truth.
That's right. And frankly, to a certain extent, I believe once the Republicans start yelling and screaming about election fraud, not voter fraud, because they like to make up this phony issue that voters are voting twice and dead people and all of that, I mean, which is really a red herring in comparison to this election fraud that we see that affects millions of votes. But when they come out and when the Republicans come out and make an issue of this, then finally something, I promise, will get done.
Is the major problem with it the proprietary issue? Is that the biggest thing that we have biggest issue we have with
it. I mean, that's where it all sort of starts. The fact that you know, we have allowed these private companies to say that their source code is proprietary, it's a trade secret, and we are not allowed to see how it works. And that's how all of this problem begins, because you're using software then that nobody has actually gotten to test. And you have no idea if it works or not. Now, if it was open, if it was source code, if any American in the world could get in there and look at it and discover it, you know, we might have gotten off on the right page. We have now gotten off on such a horribly wrong footing with this secret software and this whole secret society, really, that has grown up around it. I mean, if you try to go into your election officials and ask them questions, they will be suspicious of you. You will be suspicious of them. And you know, all of these secrets are being kept. It's incredible. All we're talking about is adding one plus one. You know, this isn't really rocket science. And yet, why the secrecy? Why are public officials making it so hard to verify these things? You know, out here in the Busby-Bilbray race, they've had a 1% audit by state law. It's supposed to be a manual, random audit. And yet, we can't even get results of that audit. Why? What's the secret here?
Yeah, and I can tell you, I mean, I get to talk to several of the people ahead of the Department of Elections in the counties, surrounding counties, and our counties here, and they actually really resent it when you ask them any questions about the voting machines. They really do have a built-in resentment when you ask it. They look at you with a jaundiced eye, like, what do you know, they get very defensive right off the bat.
Oh, yeah, which is all the more reason to keep asking them. I've got a video over at Brad Blog. I think I called it something like Election Director Gone Wild, where you've got on videotape an Election Integrity Advocate asks him about these touchscreen voting machines made by Diebold that they were bringing into Arizona, and this election director just flipped out. Brad Nelson was his name. He just completely flipped out at just having the question asked, and he knew he was being videotaped. So what is that about, guy?
Yeah,
I mean, it makes no sense.
No.
It's really bizarre.
Well, I don't think we're going to have, you know, I was talking to a guest we had on before you were on today, and I was hearkening back to the days when my first political campaign, and I know all my listeners are going, oh, God, he's going to say that again. what was the Kennedy campaign? And you know, it was a hard-fought election, and we didn't like Richard Nixon and all that, but when it was all over with, everybody shook hands and said, all right, we're all Americans, let's get down to governing the country, and we'll support the president. I don't have to like him, but we'll support him. God, how things have changed over the years. It's just turned into a big war. I mean, I'm a partisan. I am. I admit it. But I wish things weren't quite so partisan as they are right now.
It's incredibly ugly. This whole right left red blue nonsense is incredibly damaging to this country, and not because, you know, there's disagreements about issues. That's what America is all about. What it becomes dangerous and it becomes troubling when you've got this notion that there are two opposing sides to every issue. There is no gray. There is no nuance. There is nowhere in between. But most disturbingly, when you've got quite often one of the sides in the issue completely making stuff up.
Yeah.
I mean, just out and out lying. How do you have a legitimate debate when you got one person with one point of view and the other side of the debate where people are just lying? That's what we've got.
That's so right. And you see so many votes come up nowadays where it's 100% of the Republicans on one side, 100% of the Democrats on the other side. You think, how can this be?
It doesn't make any sense, you know, and that goes back to that moment I was mentioning earlier at Camp Casey, where we were able to bring both sides together when the media wasn't looking, and we were both able to, you know, sort of honestly recognize what the values are, that, you know, the reason why Camp Casey had existed in the first place, which was to, you know, try to save lives, try to honor the lives, those folks who have been lost, and that's really what has been lost in this debate, is, you know, the people here. It's become a business. It's become a big business, and the media just perpetuates this right, left, red, blue nonsense that is tearing the country apart. And of course, I'm sorry to say, it does start with the Republicans, because very cynically, that is their plan to win elections. And it's not about what's good for the country. It is about what needs to be done to stay in power. And if they have to lie and make stuff up to do it and break the law, then they will do it.
It's all about feeding. It's all about feeding K Street.
That's right.
That's really it. That's where it's at, right there, K Street.
K Street and the military industrial complex, who is doing quite well, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Don't think there's ever been a better time for them than right
sure.
now. Especially during especially not during a time of war. This war is so limited in numbers, but dollar wise, it certainly isn't. We're certainly spending monstrous amounts of money.
You bet.
Well, Brad, it's been a pleasure having you on. We need to get together and chat about this weekly thing. And how soon are you going to do your vacation? We'll just lay this out in front of everybody.
Well, we're going down to Democracy Fest down in San Diego next weekend, where I'll be speaking on a couple of panels concerning election reform and blogging and everything else. That's the July San Diego University. The, 14, 15, 16, something like that. And after that, I hope to hit the road, be gone as long as I can, and hopefully then be back in business. Let's call it mid to late August.
Okay.
So I'd be delighted to come on weekly and chat with you, Guy. It's always a delight. So let's talk about doing that. If you're interested, if your listeners would like me, I would love to be here for you.
Oh, I've been looking at the chat rooms here. People saying yes, let's do this. So we will. We'll get in touch. Brad,
thanks
so much for being on the show today.
I appreciate it.
Brad Friedman, ladies and gentlemen, and he's done yeoman's duty, as you all well know, about finding out what the problems are and maybe some of the answers with the black box voting issues. We've got to get that solved. We've got to get that issue. I don't think the rest of it makes a damn bit of difference anymore unless we get that solved. I don't care. We can vote on all the things we want to vote on, but unless we know that we've got honest and open voting going on here in this country, why we're just going to have a hell of a mess on our hands from now, in ad infinitum, as they say. So what are we going to do right now? I guess we're going to go to a break right now. And I had a request for this, so I'm going to play it today. Here you go.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I wanna be just like my president. I wanna make more money than I can spend. I wanna build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Come all you black and Hispanic boys, we'll keep you poor so you got no choice but to join the army in your prime and fight for Uncle Sam and die. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
Ah, yes. We're back. Still got, what, oh, a little bit over a quarter hour to go. We hope you'll give us a call here at the Guy James Show. 866-546-5254. Would enjoy hearing from you. 866-546-5254. That's the idea of the program, you know, to hear from you. Not just you hearing from me. We need to hear from you as well. We need to, part of the reason for this program is to take the pulse of America so that we know what we're talking about when we talk to people about all things political, that we know what the grassroots are thinking. And that's what you folks are, the grassroots, the net roots. That's what we all are. And we need to know what that particular segment of political beings is thinking. And, you know, I feel so bad that I think we're being ignored by our government. And it doesn't mean, and I'm not going to be partisan at all with this issue, I don't think. I've tried my best not to be partisan when I was thinking about this and looked up some stats on it. And I think I'm being fair. I think I'm not going to be partisan in what I want to tell you about. But I think we're being just insulted and ignored by our own government. You know, it's supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. And yet, the people, you and I, are being almost totally ignored by the bureaucrats in Washington. And I don't care. I don't care which side. You know, most Republicans, and sadly some Democrats too, more often than not, vote against the wishes of the majority of the people. And I've looked up some examples of important issues. 67% of the people, according to the CNN USA Today Gallup poll, and it's a major poll, 67% of the people polled say Bush doesn't have a clear plan for handling the situation in Iraq. 67%. Shouldn't that mean something? And yet many Democrats and almost all of the Republican legislators are staying with Bush on his insane stay-the-course policy. How can they ignore our wishes on something this so vitally important to the country? And so vitally important in so many ways. And Johnny O saying on the chat room, this is why Lieberman has to go. I heartily agree. I absolutely agree. How can they ignore us? And yet they are. So many of them are ignoring us. According to a Wall Street Journal poll, 66% of Americans don't want Roe v. Wade overturned. 66%. Two-thirds of the people. And yet the extremist Republicans are working toward doing exactly that by stacking the Supreme Court. And make no mistake about it, opinions on Roe v. Wade are a litmus test for the justices appointed by Bush. We know that. I'll get to the phones here in a moment, just for you folks on the phone. 69% of the Americans favor providing more generous government assistance to the poor, according to Pew Research, a very, very well-respected group, Pew. 69% favor providing more generous government assistance to the poor, and yet our government is cutting and slashing every program for the poor that they possibly can. It's absolutely shameful. And according to a Gallup poll, 83% of Americans support raising the minimum wage. And how's Congress responding? You know, how are they responding to the wishes of the people on that issue? Nothing. Greedy bastards vote themselves a raise and leave the minimum wage earners to starve or work more hours. That's always the answer. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps like I did. Hey, you know, I'm tired of hearing that one. Try sitting down, grabbing your bootstraps one time and pulling yourself up by your bootstrap. You end up falling on your head. 62% of Americans say they'd prefer a universal health care system to the current program. 62%. That's according to an ABC poll. Are we getting anywhere with a universal health care system? 68% of Americans consider reforming the public schools. The public schools, folks. That's the way to handle education. Only 23% of the people favor finding an alternative to public schools. That's a Gallup poll. And yet more vouchers and private schools are showing up every single day. We're headed for an education nightmare in this country, when only the rich will be able to afford even a grade school education. For-profit schools, there's one right up the road from where I live. For-profit schools are popping up everywhere, and not always with the greatest results either. I want to make that very clear. But the almighty dollar is more important than our kids' education any day to our legislators' way of thinking. We've been betrayed by our legislators on that. 77% of Americans say that the country should do whatever it takes to protect the environment. 77%, another Pew Research poll. Are the right-wing extremists in power right now paying any attention whatsoever to the environment? When you get some time sometimes, check out their Save the Forest and Clean Air Act. You'll love that. And 65% of the American people feel the right to privacy has either been lost or is under serious threat. Can you say Patriot Act? We're being ignored, folks. Not just by the Republicans. Oh, no. Let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hello, Juanita.
Excellent interviews.
Thank you.
Great interviews. Of course, that one yesterday was, too. But I like to hear different ideas, you know, and you and he were able to discuss something without one getting mad at the other,
you know.
Like that.
I do, too.
You know, we're liberals. We like to hear the different things because...
You bet.
Something can always get better, be better, you know.
I always listen. Always.
And, I tried to understand the conservative point of view, and just didn't register with me, but I did try to understand it. But I'll just tell you one little thing about Medicare Part D.
Yes.
The prescription. This is an experience now to show you how nothing makes any sense. This person coverage was being paid by the state of Florida. And all of a sudden in May, they got a notice that Florida was no longer going to pay it because they lowered the amount of money that you can make.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And anyway, this person had to pay back payments even though he hadn't been notified, you know, that...
It
came out of the one check. It just said, you know, Social Security. Never heard anything from the state of Florida. But this person got another coverage, you know. But anyhow, they tell you at the Social Security office, I don't know if anybody knows this, they say, well, if you're going to go off of Medicare and then something happens, if you decide to go back on Medicare, then you will be penalized. You know, I knew that they would be they were going to penalize people that were late in enrolling. But also, if you accept one of these others that will pay for your prescriptions and pay part of it through the donut hole, then you'll be penalized if something happens and they're no longer in business. Then you go back to Medicare.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I know you're probably not a big gambler, but I'm not either. But it's a stacked deck, is exactly what it is.
Yeah,
they've got the deck stacked.
And they're trying to get people to go on these other programs.
Oh, sure. And that donut hole, if memory serves me, that the seniors got to start picking up the tab somewhere around
$2,500.
Yeah, it's from like $2,200 to $5,100, right in there.
It's like... Oh, it's more than that. It's like almost 3,000 or something in between the donut hole is.
Yeah.
Other insurances will pay for some of that. But, and the government, they're saying, oh, well, seniors should get on them. What I'm saying is nothing makes any sense. Nothing is logical.
No.
Yet, if you do go on them and then you have to go off, you're going to be penalized.
Yeah, logic is a word you don't want to use.
Anyway, I just wanted to tell you about that.
Well, thank you, Juanita. And
okay.
We're going to have a whole show on that coming up soon in a couple of weeks. Thank
but
you.
But I love that other. I mean, I think we should see what those his ideas, you know.
Oh, yeah, Harlan Ullman. The guy's been around the block. Check him out on the Internet, Harlan Ullman. Google him. You'll find a lot of information on him.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Isn't it a shame? Isn't it a damn shame? Since 2000, premiums for employer-sponsored health insurance for families have increased by 73%. There's only been a 14% increase in inflation, folks, but the employer-sponsored health insurance for families is going up by 73%. And they know. They got you, don't they? It's something you need. It's something you got to have, and so let's just keep shoving it to them until they can't take it anymore. They'll pay. Oh, they'll pay, all right. They've got kids, they'll pay. Sock it to them. As of 2004, over 46 million Americans, including more than 8 million children, were totally uninsured. And at least $286 billion, enough to cover all of the uninsured and enough to provide full health care coverage for everyone in the United States, is annually wasted on overhead paperwork by competing insurance companies. In 2003, HMOs nearly doubled their profits from the previous year. What kind of an industry doubles their profits from the year before? Totaled more than $10 billion in all. And the health industry spent more than $300 billion. And here's the secret to the whole thing. Here's the key. If you're looking for the key to the whole thing, the health industry spent more than $300 million on lobbying in 2003, and another $300 million in campaign contributions since 2000. Those two figures are obscene. Obscene. $600 million on lobbying and campaign contributions to buy themselves whatever they want in Congress. And you know what? It worked. It worked. Because they bought all the congressmen and senators that they needed to get their way with the American public. They bought them, they paid for them, and they've got them. Just raised the prices before this new bill went into effect on prescription. Can't even negotiate the prices with them. Who the hell was stupid enough to do that? You know, I think it was Dennis Kucinich said, we're already paying for universal coverage. We're just not getting it. And that's the truth. That is the truth. We live in the country with the finest, most comprehensive medical care in the world. People from all over the world come here if they have a choice for their medical care, if they can afford it. But isn't it a shame that that wonderful medical care, that great technology that's available in this country, can't be accessed by most of America? That is shameful. It's absolutely shameful. I think if there's one thing that America owes all of its citizens, any rich country, any wealthy country like us owes its citizens, is health care. Health care. We all need it. We're all going to have it. This country can't afford it. It should be a right, not a privilege. And yet about 46 million people in this country do not have health care. And the shame of it is, our health care costs wouldn't be as high, especially for those who don't have it, because, you know, if you're uninsured, you're less likely to have a mammogram and other early detection tests, things that can help prevent serious illness and death. Uninsured people don't get those things, and they die earlier. The poor die earlier. That's what a shame. What a shame that is in the richest country in the world, that the poor die earlier. My God, that makes me ashamed. Well, we've had an interesting show today. I'm glad to have all of you along with us, as always. Ooh, tomorrow's Friday already. This being a holiday week, time went kind of kind of quickly, I guess you might say. Thanks to both of our guests being on today. Harlan Allman and Brad Friedman, as always. Brad, a wealth of information about something so very important, and Harlan's book, well worth reading as well. America's, check him out on the Google. You find us some good reading there. Well, thanks for listening today. We've had an interesting show. We'll have a good show for you tomorrow, I promise. Friday and all. TGIF. Always remember, this is a listener-supported program. We could use your help right now in a big way, believe me. You've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Have a good one, folks. See you tomorrow.